even more courted than John Jeffries, and decided not to change his habits. "I've spent 3 weeks with that girl, and she's the most fantastic subject I ever had. Even if she makes the stuff up, and maybe she does, it'll be the best book I'll ever do. She's had a horrible life. Horrible. It makes you weep just to hear it. I sit there and cry. I tell you, she's wasted in that piece of Broadway fluff. Wasted. She'll be a great tragic actress once she's out of her teens." Red-faced, Edward guffawed at his own preposterousness. Like John, he too was in flight. "You too seem to have caught that girl like a virus," Ricky said. John giggled, and Edward said, "The whole world will, Ricky. She's really got that gift." "Oh," Ricky said, remembering something. "Your nephew Donald seems to be having a great success with his new book. Congratulations."
"It's nice to know I'm not the only talented bastard in the family. And it should help him get over his brother's death. That was an odd story, a very odd story. They both seem to have been engaged to the same woman. But we don't want to think about anything macabre tonight. We're going to have fun."
John Jaffrey nodded in happy agreement. 4.
"I saw your son downstairs, Walt," Ricky said to Walter Barnes, the older of the two bankers. "He told me his decision. I hope he makes it."
"Yeah, Pete's decided on Cornell. I always hoped he'd at least apply to Yale, my old school. I still think he'd make it."
A heavyset man with a stubborn face like his son's, Barnes was disinclined to accept Ricky's congratulations.
"The kid isn't even interested anymore. He says Cornell's good enough for him." "Good enough? His generation's even more conservative than mine. Cornell's the kind of rinky-dink place where they still have food fights. 9 or 10 years ago, I used to be worried that Pete would grow up to be a radical with a beard and a bomb. Now I'm afraid he'll settle for less than he could get."
Ricky made vague noises of sympathy.
"How are your kids doing? They both still out on the West Coast?"
"Yes. Robert's teaching English in a high school. Jane's husband just got a vice presidency."
"Vice president in charge of what?"
"Safety."
"Oh, well."
They both sipped at their drinks, refraining from trying to invent comment on what a promotion to vice president in charge of safety might mean in an insurance company.
"They planning to get back here for Christmas?"
"I don't think so. They both have pretty active lives."
In fact, neither of their children had written to Ricky and Stella for several months. They had been happy infants, sullen adolescents, and now, both of them nearly 40, were unsatisfied adults. In many ways, still adolescent. Robert's few letters were barely concealed pleas for money. Jane's were superficially bright, but Ricky read desperation in them.
"I'm really getting to like myself now."
A statement which to Ricky meant its opposite. Its glibness made him wince. Ricky's children, the former darlings of his heart, were now like distant planets. Their letters were painful. Seeing them was worse.
"No," he said, "I don't think they'll be able to make it this time."
"Jane's a pretty girl," Walter Barnes said.
"Her mother's daughter."
Ricky automatically began to look around the room to catch a glimpse of Stella, and saw Millie Sheehan introducing his wife to a tall man with stooping shoulders and thick lips, the academic nephew. Barnes asked,
"Have you seen Edward's actress?"
"She's here somewhere. I saw her come down."
"John Jaffrey seems very excited about her."
"She is really sort of unnervingly pretty,"
Ricky said, and laughed.
"Edward's been unnerved, too."
"Pete read in a magazine that she's only 17 years old."
"In that case, she's a public menace." When Ricky left Barnes to join his wife and Millie Sheehan, he caught sight of the little actress. She was dancing with Freddie Robinson to a Count Basie record, and she moved like a delicate bit of machine tooling, her eyes shining greenly. His arms about her, Freddie Robinson looked stupefied with happiness. Yes, the girl's eyes were shining, Ricky saw, but was it with pleasure or mockery? The girl turned her head. Her eyes sent a current of emotion across the room to him, and Ricky saw in her the person his daughter Jane, now overweight and discontented, had always wanted to be. As he watched her dance with foolish Freddie Robinson, he understood that there before him was a person who would never have cause to utter the damning phrase that she was really getting to like herself. She was a little flag of self-possession.
"Hello, Millie," he said. "You're working hard."
"Oh, poof, when I'm too old to work, I'll lay down and die. Did you have anything to eat?"
"Not yet. This must be your nephew."
"Oh, please forgive me. You haven't met."
She touched the arm of the tall man beside her.
"This is the brainy one in my family, Harold Sims. He's a professor at the college, and we've just been having a nice talk with your wife. Harold, this is Frederick Hawthorne, one of the doctor's closest friends."
Sims smiled down at him.
"Mr. Hawthorne's a charter member of the Chowder Society," Millie concluded.
"I was just hearing about the Chowder Society," Harold Sims said. His voice was very deep. "It sounds interesting."
"I'm afraid it's anything but."
"I'm speaking from the anthropological point of view. I've been studying the behavior of male, chronologically related interaction groups. The ritual content is always very strong. Do you, members of the Chowder Society, actually wear dinner jackets when you meet?"
"Yes, I'm afraid we do."
Ricky looked to Stella for help, but she had mentally abstracted herself and was gazing coolly at both men.
"Why is that, exactly?"
Ricky felt that the man was about to pull a notebook from his pocket.
"It seemed like a good idea 100 years ago. Millie, why did John invite half the town if he's going to let Freddie Robinson monopolize Miss Moore?"
Before Millie could answer, Sims asked,
"Are you familiar with the work of Lionel Tiger?"
"I'm afraid I'm abysmally ignorant," Ricky said.
"I'd be interested in observing one of your meetings. I suppose that could be arranged?"
Stella laughed at last and gave him a look which meant, "Get out of that."
"I suppose differently," Ricky said. "But I could probably get you into the next Kiwanis meeting."
Sims reared back, and Ricky saw that he was too unsure of his dignity to take jokes well.
"We're just 5 old coots who enjoy getting together," he quickly said. "Anthropologically, we're a washout. We're of no interest to anyone."
"You're of interest to me," said Stella. "Why don't you invite Mr. Sims and your wife to the next meeting?"
"Yeah!"
Sims began to show an alarming quantity of enthusiasm.
"I'd like to record for a start, and then the video element.
Do you see that man over there?"
Ricky nodded in the direction of Sears James, who more than ever resembled a storm cloud in human form. It looked like Freddie Robinson, now separated from Miss Moore, was trying to sell him insurance.
"The big one. He'd slit my throat if I did any such thing."
Millie looked shocked. Stella lifted her chin and said,
"Very nice meeting you, Mr. Sims," and left them.
Harold Sims said,
"Anthropologically, that's a very interesting statement."
He regarded Ricky with an interest even more professional.
"The Chowder Society must be highly important to you."
"Of course it is," Ricky said simply.
"From what you just said, I'd assume that the man you just pointed out
is the dominant figure in the group, as it were the honcho.
Very astute of you, Ricky said. Now, if you'll forgive me, I see someone I must have a word with.
When he had turned his back and gone away only a few steps, he heard Sims ask Millie,
"Are those two really married?"
5.
Ricky stationed himself in a corner, deciding he'd wait things out. He had a good, mostly unobstructed view of the party. He'd be quite happy just watching things until it was time to go home. The record having come to an end, John Jeffrey appeared beside the portable stereo and put another one on the turntable. Louis Benedict, drifting up beside him, seemed amused, and when the sound began to issue from the speakers, Ricky heard why. It was a record by Aretha Franklin, a singer Ricky knew only from the radio. Where on earth would John Jaffrey have obtained such a record, and how long ago had he done it? He must have bought it specifically for the party. This was a fascinating concept, but Ricky's deliberations on it were interrupted by a succession of people who joined him, one by one, in his corner. The first person who found him was Clark Mulligan, the owner of the Rialto, Milburn's only movie theater. His hush puppies were unaccustomedly clean, his trousers pressed, his belly successfully contained by his jacket button. Clark had spruced himself up for the evening. Presumably he knew that he had been invited for his relation to show business. Ricky thought it must have been the first time John had had Clark Mulligan in his home. He was glad to see him. He was always glad to see him. Mulligan was the only person in town who shared his love of old movies. Hollywood gossip bored Ricky, but he loved the films of its golden days.
"Who does she remind you of?" he asked Mulligan.
Mulligan squinted across the room. The actress was standing demurely across the room, listening to something said by Ed Venuti.
"Mary Miles Minter? She reminded me of Louise Brooks, though I don't suppose Louise Brooks's eyes were green.
Who knows?
She's supposed to be a damn fine little actress, though. Cropped up just out of nowhere. Nobody knows anything about her."
"Edward does."
"Oh, he's doing one of his books, isn't he?
The interviewing is nearly done. It's always difficult for Edward to say goodbye to his subjects, but this time it will be especially traumatic. I think he fell in love with her."
And indeed, Edward had jealously joined Ed Venuti and managed to interpose himself between the banker and the little actress.
"I'd fall in love with her too," Mulligan said. "Once they get their faces up on the screen, I fall in love with all of them. Have you seen Martha Keller?"
His eyes rolled.
"Not yet, but from the photos I've seen, she looks a lot like a modern Constance Talmadge."
"Are you kidding? How about Paulette Goddard?"
And from there they went happily on to speak of Chaplin, of Monsieur Verdú, of Norma Shearer and John Ford, Eugene Paulette and Harry Carey Jr., Stagecoach and the Thin Man, Veronica Lake and Alan Ladd, John Gilbert and Rex Bell, Jean Harlow, Charlie Farrell, Janet Gaynor, Nosferatu and Mae West, actors and films Ricky had seen as a younger man and had never ceased youthfully to cherish, and the fresh memory of them helped to dampen the recollection of what a young man had said about himself and his wife.
"Wasn't that Clark Mulligan?"
His second visitor was Sonny Venuti, Edward's wife.
"He looks terrible."
Sonny herself had changed over the past few years, from a slender, pretty woman with a lovely smile, to a bony stranger with an uneasy, dazed expression permanently fixed in her eyes. A casualty of marriage. 3 months before, she had come into Ricky's office and asked what she had to do to get a divorce.
"I'm not sure yet, but
I'm definitely thinking about it. I have to find out where I am.
Yes, there was another man, but she would not name him.
I'll tell you this, though. He's good-looking and intelligent, and he's as close to sophisticated as you can get in this town.
She had left no doubt that the man was Lewis. Such women always reminded Ricky Hawthorne of his daughter, and he had led her through all of her options gently, outlining all the steps, explaining everything carefully and succinctly, though he knew she would never return.
She's beautiful, isn't she? Oh, entirely. I talked to her for a second. Yes. She wasn't interested. She's only interested in men. She'd love you.
At the moment, the actress was talking to Stella, not 10 feet away, which seemed to undercut Sonny Venuti's statement. Ricky watched the two women conversing without hearing their words. Sonny went on at some length to explain why the actress would love him. The subject of these remarks was listening to Stella. She responded. Both women were lovely, cool, amused. Then Miss Moore said something that visibly confounded Stella. Ricky's wife blinked, opened her mouth, snapped it shut, patted her hair. If she had been a man, she'd have scratched her head. And Veronica Moore, trailed by Edward Wanderley, went off.
"So I'd watch myself," Sonny Venuti was saying. "She might look like a little angel, but that kind of woman loves to turn men into hash." "Pandora's box," said Ricky, reminded of his first impression of the actress. "What? Oh, never mind, I know, it's an old movie. When I came to you that time, you mentioned Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy twice. How are things now, Sonny?"
"I'm trying again. Jesus, how I'm trying. Who can get a divorce in Milburn? But I still want to find out who I am."
Ricky thought of his daughter, and his heart twisted. Then Sears James joined Ricky in his corner.
"Privacy at last," he said,
putting his drink on a table and leaning against the bookshelves.
"I wouldn't count on it."
"An appalling young man tried to sell me insurance. He lives across the street."
"I know him."
Since they were in total agreement on the subject of Freddie Robinson, there was nothing more to say. Eventually, Sears broke the silence.
"Lewis might need help getting home. He's been a bit bibulous."
"Well, after all, it's not one of our meetings."
"I suppose he might pick up a girl who could drive him home."
Ricky glanced at him to see if he meant this personally, but Sears was merely surveying the party blandly, obviously bored.
"Did you talk to the guest of honor?"
"I haven't even seen her."
"She's highly visible. I think she's over..."
He lifted his drink in the direction he had seen her, but the actress was no longer there. Edward was talking to John, presumably about her, but Anne Veronica Moore was no longer in the room.
"Keep an eye on Edward. He'll find her."
"Isn't that Walter Barnes's son standing by the bar?"
Though it was now long past 10, Peter Barnes and a young girl were indeed by the bar, and the waiter, who had relieved Millie of her duties, was mixing drinks for them. Dr. Jaffrey's housekeeper had clearly not had the heart to send away the teenagers downstairs, and the bolder ones had invaded the upstairs party. The piano music, which had replaced Aretha Franklin, abruptly ceased, and Ricky saw Jim Hardy juggling several record albums, trying to decide which was least out of date.
"Uh-oh," he said to Sears. "We have a new disc jockey."
"That's it," Sears said. "I'm tired and I'm going home. Noisy music makes me want to bite someone."
He moved massively away. Millie Sheehan stopped his progress and spoke agitatedly to him. Ricky guessed that she was in a tizzy over the sudden appearance of the teenagers.
Sears shrugged. It was not his problem.
Ricky wanted to go home then, but Stella had begun to dance with Ned Rolls, and soon several of the wives had enticed their husbands to that part of the room nearest the record player. The teenagers danced energetically, sometimes almost elegantly. The adults looked foolishly imitative beside them. Ricky groaned. It was going to be a long night. All had begun to speak louder. The barman mixed a half a dozen drinks at a time, moving an upended bottle over a row of ice-filled glasses. Sears reached the door and disappeared. Christina Barnes, a tall blonde with an avid face, appeared by Ricky.
"Since my son has managed to take over this party, how about dancing with me, Ricky?"
Ricky smiled.
"I'm afraid I can't be a gentleman, Christina. I haven't danced in 40 years. "You must do something pretty well to hang on to Stella all these years."
She'd had about 3 drinks too many.
"Yes," he said. "You know what it was. I never lost my sense of humor."
"Ricky, you're wonderful. I'd love to give you a back rub one of these days and see if I could find out what you're made of."
"Old pencil stubs and out-of-date law books."
Clumsily, she kissed him, hitting the edge of his jaw.
"Did Sonny Fanuti see you a couple of months ago? I want to talk to you about it."
"Then come to my office," he said, knowing she would not.
"Excuse me, Ricky, Christina," said Edward Wanderley, who had come up on Ricky's other side.
"I'll leave you men to your private business."
Christina went off in search of a dancing partner.
"Have you seen her? Do you know where she is?"
Edward's broad face was boyish, anxious.
"Miss Moore? Not for a little while. Have you lost her?"
"Damn, she just vanished."
"She's probably in the bathroom."
"For 25 minutes?
Edward rubbed his forehead.
"Don't worry about her, Edward."
"I'm not worried, I just want to find her."
He stood on tiptoe and began to look over the heads of the dancers, still grinding his fist into his forehead.
"You don't suppose she went off with one of those awful kids?"
"Couldn't say."
Edward slapped his shoulder and went rapidly out into the room. Christina Barnes and Ned Rolls appeared in the vacuum Edward left at the edge of the carpet, and Ricky went around them to look for Stella. After a moment he saw her with Jim Hardy, obviously declining an invitation to learn the bump. She looked over at him with some relief and separated from the boy. The music was so loud they had to speak directly into one another's ears.
"That's the most forward boy I've ever met."
"What did he say?"
"He said I looked like Anne Bancroft."
The music abruptly stopped, and Ricky's reply carried over the entire party.
"No one under 30 should be allowed to enter a movie theater."
Everyone but Edward Wanderley, who was quizzing a hostile Peter Barnes, turned to look at Ricky and Stella. Then the ever-hopeful Freddie Robinson took the hand of Jim Hardy's girlfriend. Another record fell onto the turntable, and people went back to the business of being at a party. Edward had been speaking softly, insistently, but Peter Barnes's aggrieved voice floated out a moment before the music began.
"Jesus, man, maybe she went upstairs."
"Can we go?" he asked Stella. "Sears left a while ago."
"Oh, let's stay a while. We haven't done anything like this in ages. I'm having fun, Ricky."
When she saw his crestfallen face, she said,
"Dance with me, Ricky, just this once."
"I don't dance," he said, making himself heard over the din of the music.
"Enjoy yourself, but let's go in about half an hour, all right?"
She winked at him, turned away, and was immediately captured by gangsterish Lou Price, to whom this time she succumbed. Edward, seeing nothing, rushed by. Ricky walked around the edges of the party for a time, refusing drinks from the barman. He spoke to Millie Sheehan, who was sitting exhausted on the couch.
"I didn't know it would turn out like this," Millie said. "It'll take hours to clean up. Make John help you."
"He always helps," Millie said, radiance touching her plain round face.
"He's wonderful that way."
Ricky wandered on, at last arriving at the top of the stairs. Silence from upstairs and down. Was Edward's actress up there with one of the boys? He smiled and went downstairs for the quiet. The doctor's offices were deserted. Lights burned, cigarettes had been stamped out on the floor, half-filled cups stood on every surface. The rooms smelled of sweat, beer, smoke. The little portable record player in the front room spun on, the needle clicking in the empty grooves. Ricky lifted the tone arm, put it on its support, and turned the machine off. Millie would have a lot of work down here the next morning. He looked at his watch. 12:30. Through the ceiling came the thumping of a bass, a tinny echo of music. Ricky sat in one of the stiff waiting room chairs, lit a cigarette, sighed, and relaxed. He wondered if he might help Millie by beginning to straighten up these downstairs rooms, then realized that he'd need a broom. He was too tired to go scouting for a broom. A few minutes later, footsteps woke him out of a light doze. He straightened up in his chair, listening to someone opening a door at the bottom of the stairs. "Hello?" he called out, not wanting to embarrass an illicit couple. "Who's that?"
"Ricky?"
John Jaffrey came into the front waiting room.
"What are you doing here? Have you seen Edward?"
"I came down for the quiet. Edward was rushing around trying to find Miss Moore. Maybe he went upstairs."
"I'm worried about him," Jaffrey said. "He looks so taut. And Veronica's dancing with Ned Rolls. Couldn't he see her?"
"She vanished a while back. That's why he was anxious."
"Oh, poor Edward. He doesn't have to worry about that girl. She's good as gold. You should see her. She's absolutely lovely. She looks better than she has all night."
"Well," he pushed himself out of the stiff chair, "do you want help finding Edward?"
"No, no, no. You just carry on. I'll find him. I'll try the bedrooms, though what he'd be doing there."
"Still looking, I expect."
John wheeled around, muttering that he couldn't help but worry, and went back through the consulting rooms. Ricky slowly followed. Harold Sims was dancing with Stella, holding her tightly and keeping up a steady stream of talk into her ear. The music was so loud that Ricky wanted to scream. Nobody but Sears had left, and the young people, many of them now drunk, whirled about, hair and arms flying. The little actress cavorted with the editor. Lewis was talking to Christina Barnes on the couch. Both were oblivious to the presence of sleeping Millie Sheehan, not 8 inches away. Ricky wished profoundly that he were in his bed. The noise gave him a headache. His old friends, Sears accepted, seemed to have lost their minds. Lewis had his hand on Christina Barnes's knee, and his eyes were unfocused. Was he really trying to seduce his banker's wife in the presence of her husband and son? Upstairs, something heavy fell over, and only Ricky heard it. He went back out onto the landing and saw John Jaffrey standing at the top of the stairs.
"Ricky!"
"What's wrong, John?"
"Edward! It's Edward!
Did he knock something over?"
"Come up here, Ricky."
Ricky went up, growing a little more worried with each step. John Jaffrey seemed very shaken.
"Did he knock something over? Did he hurt himself?"
Jaffrey's mouth opened. Finally, sounds emerged. I knocked a chair over. I don't know what to do.
Ricky reached the landing and looked into Jaffrey's ruined face.
Where is he?
The second bedroom.
Since Jaffrey did not move, Ricky went across the hall to the second door. He looked back. Jaffrey nodded, swallowed, and finally came toward him.
In there.
Ricky's mouth was dry. Wishing that he were anywhere else doing anything but what he was doing, he put a hand on the doorknob and turned it. The door swung open. The bedroom was cold and almost bare. Two coats, Edward's and the girl's, were laid across an exposed mattress. But Ricky saw only Edward Wanderley. Edward was on the floor, both hands clutched to his chest and his knees drawn up. His face was terrible. Ricky stepped back and nearly fell over the chair that John Jaffrey had overturned. There was no question that Edward was still alive. He did not know how he knew it, but he knew. Yet he asked,
"Did you try to feel his pulse?"
"He doesn't have a pulse. He's gone."
John was trembling just inside the door. Music, voices came up the stairwell. Ricky forced himself to kneel by Edward's side. He touched one of the hands gripping Edward's green shirt. He worked his fingers around to the underside of the wrist. He felt nothing, but he was no doctor.
"What do you think happened?"
He still could not look again at Edward's distorted face. John came further into the room.
"Heart attack? Do you think that's what it was?"
"I don't know. Yes, probably. Too much excitement.
But..."
Ricky stared up at Jaffrey and took his hand from Edward's still warm hand.
"But what?"
"I don't know. I can't say. But, Ricky, look at his face."
He looked. Rigid muscles. Mouth drawn open as if to yell. Empty eyes.
It was the face of a man being tortured, flayed alive.
"Ricky," John said, "it's not a very medical thing to say, but he looks as if he was scared to death."
Ricky nodded and stood.
That was just how Edward looked. "We can't let anyone come up here. I'll go down and phone for an ambulance."
6. And that was the ending of Jaffrey's party. Ricky Hawthorne telephoned for an ambulance, switched off the record player, and said that Edward Wanderley had had an accident and was beyond help, and sent 30 people home. He permitted no one to go upstairs. He looked for Ann Veronica Moore, but she had already left. Half an hour later, Edward's body was on its way to hospital or morgue. Ricky drove Stella home.
"You didn't see her leave?" he asked.
"One minute she was dancing with Ned Rolls, the next minute she was out the door. I thought she was going to the bathroom."
"Ricky, how horrible." "Yes, it was horrible." "Poor Edward. I don't think I really believe it." "I don't think I do either."
Tears filled his eyes, and for some seconds he drove blindly, seeing only a streaky blur. To try to take the image of Edward's face from his mind, he asked,
"What did she say to you that surprised you so much?"
"What? When? I barely spoke to her."
"In the middle of the party, I saw her talking to you, and I thought she said something that startled you."
"Oh!" Stella's voice rose.
"She asked me if I was married. I said, 'I'm Mrs. Hawthorne.' And then she said, 'Oh, yes, I've just seen your husband. He looks like he'd be a good enemy.'"
"You couldn't have heard her correctly."
"I did."
"It doesn't make sense."
"That's what she said."
And a week later,
After Ricky had telephoned the theater where the girl was working, trying to return her coat, he heard that she had returned to New York the day after the party, abruptly quit the play and left town. Nobody knew where she was. She had vanished for good. She was too young, too new, and she left behind not even enough reputation for a legend. That night, at what looked like being the final meeting of the Chowder Society, he had, inspired, turned to a morose John Jaffrey and asked, "What's the worst thing you've ever done?" And John saved them all by answering, "I won't tell you that, but I'll tell you the worst thing that ever happened to me." And told them a ghost story. Part 2. Dr. Rabbitfoot's Revenge. Follow a shadow, it still flies you. Seem to fly it, it will pursue. Ben Jonson. Chapter 1. Just another field, but what they planted there. From the Journals of Don Wanderley. 1. The old idea of Dr. Rabbitfoot, the idea for another book, the story of the destruction of a small town by Dr. Rabbitfoot, an itinerant showman who pitches camp on its outskirts, sells elixirs and potions and nostrums, a black man, and who has a little sideshow, jazz music, dancing girls, trombones, etc., fans and bubbles. If I ever saw a perfect setting for this story, Millburn is it. First about the town, then about the good doctor. My uncle's town, Millburn, is one of those places that seems to create its own limbo and then to nest down in it. Neither proper city nor proper country, too small for one, too cramped for the other, and too self-conscious about its status. The local paper is called The Urbanite. Millburn even seems proud of its minuscule slum, the few streets called The Hollow, seems to point at it and say, "See, we've got places where you want to be careful after dark. The age hasn't left us high and dry and innocent." This is almost comedy. If trouble ever comes to Millburn, it won't start in The Hollow. 3/4 of the men work somewhere else, in Binghamton mainly. The town depends on the freeway for its life. A feeling of being oddly settled, unmoving, heavy, and at the same time nervous. I bet they gossip about one another endlessly. Nervous because they'd feel that they were forever missing something, that the age, after all, has left them high and dry. Probably I feel this because of the contrast between here and California. This is a worry they don't have there. It does seem a particularly northeast kind of anxiety, peculiar to these little towns. Good places for Dr. Rabbitfoot. Speaking of anxiety, those three old men I met today, my uncle's friends, have it bad. Obviously has to do with whatever made them write to me, not knowing that I was getting so sick of California I'd have gone anywhere I thought I might be able to work. Physically, of course, it's pretty. All these places are. Even The Hollow has a kind of sepia 30s prettiness. There's the regulation town square, the regulation trees, maples, tamarack pines, oaks, the woods full of mossy deadfalls, a sense that the woods around the town are stronger, deeper than the little grid of streets people put in their midst. And when I came in, I saw the big houses, some of them big enough to be called mansions. But still, it is wonderful, a heaven-sent setting for the Dr. Rabbitfoot novel. He's black, definitely. He dresses gaudily with old-fashioned pizzazz, spats, big rings, a cane, a flashy waistcoat. He's chirpy, show-busy, a marathon talker, slightly ominous. He's the bogeyman. He'll own you if you don't watch out.
He'll get you 7 ways to Sunday. He's got a killer smile. You only see him at night, when you pass a piece of land normally deserted, and there he is, standing on a platform outside his tent, twirling a cane while the jazz band plays. Lively music surrounds him. It whistles through his tight black hair. A saxophone curls his lips. He's looking straight at you. He invites you in to have a look at his show, to buy a bottle of his elixir for $1. He says he is the celebrated Dr. Rabbitfoot, and he's got just what your soul needs. And what if what your soul needs is a bomb, a knife, a slow death? Dr. Rabbitfoot gives you a big wink. You're on, man. Just pull $1 out of your jeans. Now, to state what is obvious. Behind this figure I've been carting around in my head for years is Alma Mobley. It also suited her to give you what you wanted. All the time, the capering smile, the floating hands, the eyes of bleached and dazzling white, his sinister gaiety. And what about that little Alma Mobley boy? Suppose you see her when you close your eyes? Then what? Is she there? Has you ever touched a ghost? Has you ever put your hand on a ghost's white skin? And your brother's peaceful eyes, was they watching you? 2. I went to the office of the lawyer who wrote to me, Sears James, as soon as I got into town. A severe white building on Wheat Row just alongside the town square. The day, gray in the morning, was cold and bright, and before I saw his receptionist I thought, maybe this is the start of a new cycle for you. But the receptionist told him that both Mr. James and Mr. Hawthorne were at a funeral. That new secretary they hired went too. But it looked a little pushy to her, because she didn't know Dr. Jaffrey at all, did she? Oh, they should be at the cemetery by now. And are you the Mr. Wanderley they've been expecting? I don't suppose you knew Dr. Jaffrey either. Oh, he was a dear, dear man. He must have been doctoring here in Milburn for 40 years. He was the kindest man you ever saw. Not sugary sweet, you know, but when he put his hands on you, you just felt the kindness flowing out. She rattled on, looking me over, inspecting me, trying to figure out just what the devil her boss wanted me for. And then this old woman sitting at her switchboard locked in with an angry smile and slapped the trump card on the table. She said, of course you don't know, but he killed himself 5 days ago. He jumped off the bridge. Can you imagine that? It was just tragic. Mr. James and Ricky Hawthorne were so upset. They still haven't gotten over it. Now that Anna girl is making them do twice as much work, and we've got that crazy Elmer Scales calling up every day, yelling at them about those 4 sheep of his. What would make a nice man like Dr. Jaffrey do a thing like that, do you imagine? He listened to Dr. Rabbitfoot, lady. Oh, you'd like to go out to the cemetery? 3. He did. It was on a road called Pleasant Hill, just out of town on one of the state roads. She gave him good directions. Long fields dying under snow that came too early, and every now and then the wind picking up a flat sheet of loose snow, making it stand up and wave its arms. Funny how lost this country seems, though people have been walking back and forth over it for hundreds of years. It looks bruised and regretful, its soul gone or withdrawn, waiting for something to happen that will wake it up again. The sign, Pleasant Hill Cemetery, was a length of stamped gray metal on one side of a black ironwork gate. If it had not been for the big gates standing at what looked like the entrance to just another hilly field, Don would have missed it.
He looked at the gates as they came nearer, wondering what kind of farmer would be grandiose enough to stick up a baronial gate at his tractor path, slowed down, glanced up at the rising narrow road, more than a tractor path, and saw half a dozen cars parked at the top of the hill. Then he saw the little plate. Just another field, but heavens, what they planted there. He swung his car through the gates. Don left his car apart from the others, halfway up the hill, and walked to the top. Nearest him was the oldest section of the cemetery, tilted slabs with pitted markings. Stone angels, lifting arms, weighted with snow. Granite young women shielded their eyes with forearms hung with drapery. Thin skeletons of weeds mounted up the leaning slabs. The narrow road bisected the old section and led into a larger region of neat, small headstones. Purple, gray, and white, these were dwarfed by the expanse of land rolling out from them. After a moment, 100 yards away, Don saw the fences surrounding the cemetery. A hearse was drawn up at the land's lowest point. The black-hatted driver cupped a cigarette so that it would not be seen by the little knot of people clustered around the newest grave. One woman, shapeless in a pale blue coat, clung to another taller woman. The other mourners stood as straight and motionless as fence posts. When I saw the two old men standing together at the base of the grave, I knew they had to be the two lawyers. If they weren't lawyers, they were from Central Casting. I started to come toward them down the slope of the narrow road. Then I thought, if the dead man was a doctor, why aren't there more people? Where are his patients? A silver-haired man beside the two lawyers saw him first and prodded the massive one, who wore a black fur-collared coat, with his elbow. The big one glanced up at him, and then the little man beside him, the one who looked as if he had a cold, also took his eyes from the minister and looked curiously at Don. Even the minister stopped talking for a moment, stuck one frozen hand in the pocket of his overcoat, and gaped at Don with rubber-faced confusion. Then, finally, a sign of welcome, a contrast to this guarded examination. One of the beauties, the younger one, a daughter, wafted toward him a small, genuine smile. The man with silver-white hair, who looked to Don as though he should have been in the movies, left the other two and sauntered toward Don. "Are you a friend of John's?" he whispered. "My name is Don Wanderley," he whispered back. "I got a letter from a man named Sears James, and the receptionist in his office said I could find him out here." "Hell, you even look a little like Edward." Lewis grabbed his bicep and squeezed. "Look, kid, we're having a rough time here. Just hang in there and don't say anything until it's all over. You got a place to stay tonight?" So I joined them, half meeting, half avoiding their glances. The woman in the pale blue coat sagged against the challenging-looking woman holding her up. Her face worked and she wailed, "Oh no, oh no, oh no." Crumpled, colored tissues lay at her feet, lifting and scampering in the wind that cut into the hollow. Every now and then, one of them shot away like a small pastel pheasant and caught in the mesh of the fence. By the time we left, there were dozens of them there, flattened out against the wire. Frederick Hawthorne. 4. Ricky had been pleased with Stella. While the three remaining members of the society had been trying to adjust to the shock of John's death, only Stella had thought of the plight of Millie Sheehan. Sears and Lewis, he supposed, had thought as he had, that Millie would simply live on in John's house, or that, if the house was too empty for her, she would put up at the Archer Hotel until she decided where to go and what to do. He and Sears knew that she had no financial troubles.
They had drawn up the will, which left Millie, John Jaffrey's house, and the contents of his bank accounts. If she added it all together, she had been willed assets of somewhere around $200,000. And if she chose to stay in Millburn, there was more than enough in the bank to pay the real estate taxes and give her a comfortable living. "We're lawyers," he said to himself. "We think like that. We can't help it. We put the pettifogging first and the people second." Of course, they were thinking of John Jaffrey. The news had come near noon of the day following that in which Ricky's premonitions had reached their height. He had known that something dreadful had happened the moment he recognized the shaky voice on the other end of the line as Millie Sheehan's.
It's,
she said, her voice trembling and cloudy.
"Mr. Hawthorne?"
"Yes, it's me, Millie," he said. "What's happened?"
He pushed the buzzer that communicated to Sears's office and told him to switch on the telephone speaker for his extension.
"What is it, Millie?"
he asked, knowing that his voice would be much too loud for Sears, but momentarily unable to speak softly. The speakers, while reproducing the client's voice at a normal volume, tripled the noise made by anyone at the other office extension.
"You're breaking my eardrums," Sears complained over the line.
"Sorry," Ricky said. "Millie, are you there?" "It's Millie, Sears."
"So I gathered. Millie, can we help you?"
"Oh,"
she wailed, and the back of his neck went cold. The phone went dead.
"Millie?"
"Pipe down," Sears commanded.
"Are you there, Millie?"
Ricky heard the telephone clattering against some hard surface. The next voice was Walt Hardesty's.
"Hey, this is the sheriff. Is this Mr. Hawthorne?"
"Yes. Mr. James is on the other line. What's going on, Walt? Is Millie all right?"
"She's standing looking out the window. What is she, anyhow, his wife? I thought she was his wife."
Sears burst in impatiently, his voice loud as a cannon in Ricky's office.
"She is his housekeeper. Now tell us what is happening out there."
"Well, she's fallen apart like a wife. You two are Dr. Jaffrey's lawyers?"
"Yes," Ricky said.
"Do you know about him yet?"
Both partners were silent. If Sears felt the way Ricky did, his throat was too tight for speech.
"Well, he was a leaper," Hardesty said. "Hey, hang on, ladies. Sit down or something." "He was a what?" Sears bellowed, his voice booming through Ricky's office.
"Well, he took a dive off the bridge this morning. He was a leaper. Lady, calm down and let me talk."
"The lady's name is Mrs. Sheehan," Sears said in a more normal voice. "She might respond better if you called her that. Now, since Mrs. Sheehan evidently wished to communicate with us and is unable to do so, please tell us what happened to John Jaffrey."
"He took a dive off—"
"Be careful. He fell off the bridge." "Which bridge?"
"Hell, the bridge over the river. What do you think?"
"What's his condition?"
"Dead as a doornail. What do you think it would be?" "Say, who's going to take care of the arrangements and all that? This lady's in no shape."
"We will," Ricky said. "We might take care of more than that," Sears uttered furiously. "Your manner is disgraceful. Your diction is shameful. You are a ninny, Hardesty."
"Just wait a damned—"
"And if you are assuming that Dr. Jaffrey committed suicide, then you are on shaky ground indeed, my friend. And you'd be well advised to keep that assumption to yourself."
"Omar Norris saw the whole thing," Hardesty said. "We need ID before we can get set for the autopsy, so why don't you get over here so we can get off the phone?"
5 seconds after Ricky put down his phone, Sears appeared in the doorway, already thrusting his arms into his coat.
"It's not true," Sears said, pulling on the coat. "It's some mistake.
but let's get over there anyway. The telephone buzzed again. Don't answer it, Sears said, but Ricky picked it up.
Yes? There's a young woman in reception who wants to see you and Mr. James, said the receptionist. Tell her to come back tomorrow, Mrs. Quast. Dr. Jaffrey died this morning, and Mr. James and I are going to his home to meet Walt Hardesty.
Why?
Mrs. Quast, who had been on the verge of indiscretion, changed subjects.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Hawthorne. Do you want me to call Mrs. Hawthorne? Yes, and say I'll be in touch as soon as I can.
By now, Sears was in a rage of impatience, and when Ricky moved around his desk, his partner was already in the hallway, twirling his hat. Ricky grabbed his coat and hurried to catch up. Together they went down the paneled hall.
That ponderous, unthinkable oaf, Sears rumbled. As if you could believe Omar Norris on any subject except bourbon and snowplows.
Ricky stopped short and put his hand on Sears's arm.
We have to think about this, Sears. John might actually have killed himself. It still hadn't sunk into him, and he could see that Sears was determined not to let it sink into him. He'd never have any reason to go walking on the bridge, and especially not in this weather.
Sears's face suffused with blood.
If you think that, you're a ninny too. I don't care if John was bird-watching. He was doing something.
His eyes avoided Ricky's.
I don't know, and I can't imagine what, but something. Did he seem suicidal to you last night?
No, but...
Therefore, let's not wrangle. Let's get over to his house.
He sped down the hall ahead of Ricky and banged open the reception room door with his shoulders. Ricky Hawthorne, hurrying after, came out into the reception room and was mildly surprised to see him confronting a tall girl with dark hair, an oval face, and small, chiseled features.
"Sears, we don't have time now, and I told this young woman to drop in tomorrow."
"She says," Sears took off his hat.
He looked as if he'd been hit on the head with a plank.
"Tell him what you told me," he said to the girl.
She said,
"Eva Galley was my aunt, and I'm looking for a job."
Mrs. Quast turned away from the girl, who had merely smiled at her, and blushed as she dialed the Hawthorne number. The girl moved away to examine the Katai graphics with which Stella, 2 or 3 years ago, had replaced Ricky's old Ottoman prints. Incomprehensible and new was Mrs. Quast's judgment on both the graphics and the girl.
"No,"
Stella Hawthorne exhaled when she had heard the news about Dr. Jaffrey.
"Oh, poor Millie. Poor everybody, I'm sure, but I'll have to do something about Millie."
When she pulls the jack from the switchboard, Mrs. Quast thinks, "My goodness, it's very bright in here," and then thinks, "No, golly, it's dark. Dark as sin. The lights must have blazed up and gone out." But the next instant, everything is normal. The lamp on her desk looks just as it always does, and she rubs her eyes and shakes her gray head. Millie Sheehan had a soft, cushy life right along, about time she went out and did a real job of work. And is astonished to hear Mr. James telling that snip of a girl that if she comes back tomorrow, they'll talk about giving her some secretarial work.
I mean, just what the dickens is going on around here?
And Ricky, looking at Sears, wondered too. Secretarial work? They had a half-time secretary, Mavis Hodge, who did most of their typing. To find enough work for another girl, they'd have to start answering their junk mail. But of course it wasn't the need for more hands on deck that made Sears treat the girl the way he did. It was that name, Eva Galley, pronounced in a voice that would taste like port wine if you could drink it.
Sears suddenly looked very tired. The sleeplessness and the nightmares and the vision of Fenny Bate and Elmer Scales and his damned sheep, and now John's death, he was a leaper, had all gathered to unstring him, if only for a moment. Ricky saw his partner's fear and exhaustion, and saw that even Sears could come unglued.
"Yes, come back tomorrow," he said to the girl. Noticed that the oval face and regular features were more than just attractive, and knew that if there was one thing Sears didn't need reminding of at that moment, it was Eva Galley. Mrs. Quast was staring at him, so he told her to deal with all incoming calls during the afternoon, just to be saying something.
"I gather that a good friend of yours has just died," the girl said to Ricky. "I'm sorry to be coming at such an awkward time,"
and ruefully smiled with what looked like genuine concern.
"Please don't let me delay you."
He glanced once more at her fox-like features before turning to Sears and the door. Sears, reflectively buttoning up his coat, white-faced, and it seemed to him that maybe Sears's instincts were right. Maybe this girl's coming was a part of the puzzle. Nothing seemed accidental anymore, as if there were some kind of plan, and if they could only get all the pieces together, they'd see what it was.
"It's probably not even John," Sears said in the car. "Hardesty is such an incompetent that I wouldn't be surprised if he took Omar Norris's word."
His voice died out. Both partners knew this was only fancy.
"Too cold," Sears said, his lips puckering out childishly.
"Too damn cold," Ricky agreed,
and finally thought of another thing to say. "At least Millie won't starve," Sears sighed, almost amused.
"Good thing, too, she'd never get another job with eavesdropping privileges."
Then there was silence again as they recognized that they were agreeing that John Jaffrey probably had stepped off the Millburn Bridge and drowned in the freezing river. After they had picked up Hardesty and driven to the tiny jail where the body was being kept until the arrival of the morgue truck, they found that Omar Norris had not been mistaken. The dead man was John. He looked even more wasted than he had in life. His sparse hair adhered to his scalp. His lips drew back over blue gums. His whole being was vacant, as in Ricky Hawthorne's nightmare.
"Jesus,"
Ricky said. Walt Hardesty grinned and said,
"That ain't the name we got, Mr. Lawyer."
"Give us the forms, Hardesty," Sears said quietly. And then, being Sears, added,
"We'll take his effects, too, unless you manage to lose them along with his dentures."
They thought they might find a clue to Jaffrey's death in the few things contained in the manila envelope Hardesty gave them. But in the collection taken from John Jaffrey's pockets, they could read nothing at all. A comb, 6 studs, and matching cufflinks. A copy of The Making of a Surgeon, a ballpoint pen, a bundle of keys in a worn leather pouch, 3 quarters, and a dime. Sears spread it over his lap in the front seat of Ricky's old Buick.
"A note was too much to hope for," Sears said, and then leaned gigantically back and rubbed his eyes. "I'm beginning to feel like a member of an endangered species."
He straightened up again and looked at the mute assortment of objects.
"Do you want to keep any of this yourself, or should we just give it to Millie?"